In a moment, we're going to be talking about Neil Armstrong.
This is the voice of the Southern Suburbs, 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, Neil Armstrong died last year, so it's just a little over a year ago now, and we're going to have a chat with someone who knows more about him than probably most other people in the world do. But first up, let's rock ourselves back to 1969 when a singer called John Stewart, a former member of the Kingston Trio, wrote a single in 1969 for Capitol Records, and he re-recorded it a couple of years later for RCA Victor. Now, the original has the voice of Armstrong on the end, but this, I think, is the 90... Well, we'll see which one we've got here. Anyway, it's John Stewart. By the way, there was an Australian version of the song produced by another singer, and we've played that previously on The Space Show, but this is the first for The Space Show. John Stewart with Armstrong.
Black boy in Chicago, playing in the street, not enough to wear, not near enough to eat. But don't you know he saw it on a July afternoon? Saw a man named Armstrong walk upon the moon. Young girl in Calcutta, barely 8 years old, flies around the marketplace. We'll see she don't get old. But don't you know she heard it on a July afternoon? Heard a man named Armstrong walk upon the moon. Heard a man named Armstrong walked upon the moon. River's getting dirty, the wind is getting bad, war and hate is killing off the only earth we had. But the world all stopped to watch it on a July afternoon. Watch a man named Armstrong walk upon the moon. Watch a man named Armstrong walk upon the moon. And I wonder, somewhere in the universe, they watched a man named Adam walk upon the earth.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
James Hansen is a writer, a professor of history at Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama, and he possibly knows more about Neil Armstrong than anyone except Neil himself. And he wrote a book called First Man, and Peter Aylward caught up with him and had this conversation about the book and the man, Neil Armstrong.
And we're joined on The Space Show by Dr. James Hansen, Professor of History at Auburn University and the author of the book First Man. Welcome to The Space Show, James.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be talking to you.
Terrific. And where are you speaking to us from, James, today?
I'm in Auburn, Alabama, where Auburn University is located, and I'm actually sitting in my office where I've been working on a new book.
Oh, a new book. Okay, so it doesn't stop?
No, it really doesn't, although I may be getting to the point where I'm going to start to slow down a little bit, but I don't know. I love to write, and if I can just get my computer set up in a way where my arm and shoulder doesn't hurt, if I'm sitting 8 to 10 hours a day writing, I'll be in better shape.
Oh, right. Wow. Okay. Well, at least you're not in the old typewriter ribbon days, I guess.
No. They've been gone for a long time now.
Yeah, for sure. So, James, you've done – I've got the First Man book here in my hand. It says that you're an author of 8 books, but this edition is from 2005. How many books have you done so far, and how many – well, you've got another one coming up by the sound of it, obviously.
Well, it may seem immodest to say I've lost count, but it's either 11 or 12 now that I've done. Of course, the Armstrong book, which came out in 2005, and then after Neil's death last August in 2012, you know, I wrote a new foreword for the book, and so it was reissued by Simon & Schuster in 2012, late in the year. And that's the book that, you know, I don't think I'll ever write one that's more significant. I don't know, maybe I can write something that would that might sell more, but that was never my goal. I always just wanted to. I probably could have sold more copies of an Armstrong book if I hadn't written such a long, detailed book. But I knew it was the only opportunity ever really to do a book about Neil, because he wasn't going to agree to any other biography. I just knew that. And so I just felt that I had to get everything recorded that anybody in future generations might be interested in.
Yeah. Well, I think I can speak for a lot of people saying that we're certainly glad you were able to do it, and Neil was agreeable for you to do it. And because, I mean, I think, you know, we all agree he passed away unexpectedly. And as you say, to be able to capture that before his passing was really important for us and for people in the future. Could you perhaps give us a rewind and tell me how the project first came to be and how you managed to basically get Neil?
Yeah. Well, I had been doing studies in aerospace history for about 20 years when I first got the idea to write Armstrong's biography. Right out of graduate school, my first professional job was to write a book for NASA, and it involved Langley Research Center in Virginia, which really was the oldest of all the NASA facilities dating back to World War I. And it was a facility where basic aerodynamic research was done in wind tunnels and also in other sorts of facilities. And so I got very, you know, my job was to get real knowledgeable about the history of aeronautical research and development. And the story, you know, that the first book I did was called Engineer in Charge, and that was published in 85. And then Langley wanted a sequel because Langley, of course, you know, the first book just took it up to the establishment of NASA in 58. Before NASA, there was an organization called the NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. And after Sputnik, when the federal government was trying to decide what to do to, you know, seemingly catch up with the Russians, they used the NACA as the nucleus for NASA. And so I wrote a second book called Spaceflight Revolution. And there then I became acquainted with R&D as it was related to, you know, aerospace. And then, of course, the projects that led to the first human spaceflight programs, and Apollo in particular. And, you know, at the time I had no idea how relevant those two books and my research would be subsequently to an Armstrong book. But, you know, Neil, who was born in 1930 and then went to school to study aeronautical engineering in the late 40s and then became he was a Korean War fighter pilot flying jet airplanes and then became a test pilot. He made this transition in his own life and in his own career from aeronautical research really into aerospace then to space. And I had made the same transitions in my own career. And so I started thinking about that a little bit in the late 90s. And I knew that biographies or autobiographies had been written, you know, about or by most of the living astronauts. And of course, we didn't have anything from Neil. I was teaching a graduate seminar in space history at the time. And I was talking to my students about, you know, my idea to try to do an Armstrong biography, and they were very encouraging to me, but I knew that it was going to be just from the stories I'd heard, I knew that Neil was difficult to get in touch with. And, I just felt like it was a real long shot. But I wrote him. I got his address. There was a mailing address that went into actually a woman who worked for him for a number of years and took care of his mail and kind of triaged his mail, determining what was, what he needed to see and what she could answer,
right,
with form letters. And my letter was passed on to him, and he wrote me back a very nice letter, but it was basically, about 2000, the year 2000, so he would have just been 70 years old then. And he was still busy with some, he was on some boards of directors for different companies. He was still active with that, and he just, I guess, hadn't decided yet that it was time to, to sit down with anyone, and he wasn't even sure, whether he wanted to write something about his own life story or not. So I got a really polite no from him, and I came back to my graduate seminar and told and showed them the letter. It's kind of cool to get a letter with Neil's signature on it. But my students encouraged me not to give up and for me to think of a way to to come at him again. And I waited a few months, and then I sent him a little box, a gift box that had copies of a couple of the books that I had written. I'd done a few more since then.
Uh-huh.
And it was really those books. And he read one of them apparently pretty carefully and got back in touch with me about that. And that opened up a conversation that eventually led, and I say eventually because it took nearly 2 years from the time I first wrote him.
All right.
Gave me the green light. So why he actually picked me in the end, is a question I never dared ask. Because, once he gave me the okay, I was, I didn't want to risk even asking why he was picking me, because I knew that he had several different authors, much more distinguished than me, that had approached him to write, books about him, and he had always turned them down. So once I got the green light, I just went to work, and I didn't ask why.
Sure, fair enough too. Absolutely. So tell me, what was the process of writing the book? Was it researching his background, interviews, or how did it actually work on a day-to-day basis for you?
Yeah, I was like, there was maybe like three elements of it. First of all, I had already, in terms of the background to his story, the context of his own career in engineering and in test piloting and in the astronaut corps, I'd already written quite a bit and researched quite a bit for 20 years before I took on the biography. So I didn't really need to know about, the history of the X-15 rocket plane or, the decision for lunar orbit rendezvous. I had researched a lot of that, and I had taught it, independent of an Armstrong biography. So that was all ready to go. What I needed to do was plug in the details of his own life. And there it was really, there were two main elements for that. One was access to his papers, which he gave me, which were in various boxes and in storage in the Cincinnati, Ohio area. And then, of course, there were records related to him that I had not researched that belonged in the NASA archives or in the records of the federal government. For example, Johnson Space Center, which was then called the Manned Spacecraft Center, where the astronauts were and where Mission Control was located, all of the papers for Johnson, once they're out of the active administrative files, go to Fort Worth, Texas, go to the Federal Records Center there. So I had to go there. I had to go to other federal records centers.
And you're listening to The Space Show.
Online all the time at southernfm.com.au.
And now we're going to return to Peter Awood's interview with James Hansen, the writer of the book First Man, which, as you've probably already gathered, is about Neil Armstrong.
But the most traveling that I did was I felt I needed to do extensive interviews. I ended up doing nearly 60 hours of taped interview with Neil over the course of many months. And then I did a total of 125 interviews with people, that living from coast to coast. I wanted to make sure that I talked to people who knew Neil, who'd worked with Neil, who had been on crews with Neil. So I spoke to virtually all the living Apollo astronauts. And I talked to a lot of people from Mission Control, people like Gene Kranz and Glenn Lunny. And I talked, I it was his whole life. It wasn't just, I went back and I talked to kids. I say kids, people that were kids with Neil when Neil was a kid.
Right.
I went back to Ohio and, you know, talked to the woman he took to the senior prom. And
oh, my goodness.
A couple of his former teachers. And then, of course, I talked to his brother and sister. He had a two years younger sister named June and a four-year younger brother named Dean. And I needed to do interviews with them. And then the hardest interview for me to arrange was the interview with Neil's first wife, Janet.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, they had been divorced for, approaching 10 years. And from Janet's point of view, why should she, go back through what really in some ways was, she had good memories, of course, but there were a lot of hard memories too, including the death of an infant child when they were, living out in California and Neil was a test pilot, the little girl had a brain tumor. And then the fact that they're divorced in the end they did divorce. And so Janet really wasn't very anxious to talk to me. And it took some negotiating, both informally and formally, to get that done. But I just felt like, again, this was going to be the one and only Armstrong biography. And to not talk to the woman who was his wife, who was there and raised his kids and was there all through, his flying career, and was there and was a historical personality herself. I mean, the astronauts' wives, they became celebrities, of a sort themselves. And I needed to hear what she had to say.
Sure.
So whatever it took, and I'll leave it at that, whatever it took, I was committed to doing it to get Janet to talk to me. And in the end, she agreed to a couple of days, really about 15, 16 hours of tape recorded interview, which I still think was crucial to the character of the book.
Mm-hmm. So did you talk to Neil's other crewmates, Dave Scott and in Apollo 11, Buzz
absolutely.
Mike?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I remember very vividly all of those interviews. I mean, with Frank, I have a very vivid memory of my interview with Frank Borman down in Las Cruces, Mexico, with Harrison Schmidt in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I interviewed Buzz actually I interviewed him a couple of times, but my lengthiest interview, he had come into Albuquerque, New Mexico on some business. He had some ideas of his that he was pitching to some companies, and he came in and I picked him up at the airport and we met the next morning and spent the morning, with an interview. So yeah, I spent a lot of time with him. I visited Mike Collins's house in South Florida. You know, there wasn't. I tried my best, Peter, not to leave any stone unturned.
Sure. No, that
it is. And the only person that I can say I didn't get to that I should have, although I don't think it's a big loss to the book, really, is Neil had two sons, and now in their late 40s, I guess, Mark and Rick. Rick is the oldest, and Rick was of an age, at the time of Apollo 11. That he had memories. I mean, he had memories of Apollo 11 and the aftermath. And so Rick agreed to, he agreed to talking to me as long as I, for as long as I wanted to. Mark was a little bit, the younger one was a little, I never really interviewed Mark, although I've talked to him a lot since. He was very, very close to his mother.
Okay.
And as long as Janet was still unsure about talking to me, Mark was going to be unsure about talking.
Right. Okay.
So then once I did get Janet talking to me, I asked her, I said, well, could you help me, could you help me with Mark? Because I would like to talk to Mark. And Janet said, well, Jim, he was so young at the time of Apollo 11, he really doesn't have any recall of it that would be helpful to you. If you've talked to Rick, you've gotten enough. And I let that go, but, honestly, I wasn't just interested in Mark's memory of Apollo 11, which might not have been there, but, what it was like to be the son of Neil Armstrong for the rest of his life, when he was in high school, when he was in college, to be Neil Armstrong's son, that was kind of part of the story, too. So I should have talked to Mark, but I was so busy crossing the country, getting to people. If someone, it just didn't look like it was one. I lowered it on the priority list a bit, but I shouldn't have. I should have talked to him too.
Well, you can always do more with these things, I guess.
There is more, actually, because, you know, the book came out in 2005, and Neil didn't die until last summer, and he was very active, as you Aussies should know. I mean, he was down there a couple of times, you know, and giving talks, and he was very active, more active than he had been his whole life in terms of testifying before the U.S. Congress, in terms of, you know, he was unhappy with some of the decisions that the Obama administration had made about, you know, the human spaceflight program. And so he testified along with Gene Cernan and former NASA Administrator Mike Griffin and Jim Lovell. And, you know, there's a lot that he did, you know, from 2005 to his death in 2012 that really needs to be put at the end of the book. And so hopefully someday, you know, I'll go back and add that. You know, it was a much bigger book, even than it's a big book now, but the editors cut it back quite a bit for, I guess, just because you have to find the price point for a book. Yeah. But I have thought about kind of putting out the, you know, what they say about movies, the director's cut.
Right. Okay.
I thought about doing that with the book because there were parts of it that were, you know, struck out of the book that, you know, that people might really be interested in knowing. The original manuscript is in the archive at Purdue University where Neil put his papers. And so, you know, in a sense, it exists what I said in its whole, but I would rather, you know, at some point maybe be able to get that director's cut published.
Sure. Well, I guess a possibility might be an ebook type of option.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. I love books. I love to, you know, and as someone who writes books, you know, you have some ambivalence about the ebook trade.
It is nice to pick it up and hold your hand and sit on the.
I do. More and more, you know, it's hard not to just pick them up off of Amazon or wherever. I mean, I've got a number of books now. In fact, one of the textbooks I'm using in a course this year, not only did I tell the students to order it as an ebook, but I've been reading it as an ebook. So, right. Times are changing and we've got to adjust to them.
Sure.
Where today's community news makes conversation, the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are in conversation with James Hansen, writer, professor of history at Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama, and our interviewer is Peter Aylward. Back now to Peter and James Hansen.
So just going back to Neil, what sort of assumptions did you have, you know, prior to engaging with him and meeting him and getting onto it, and were they overturned or confirmed, you know, after you started to work with him?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess the assumptions I went in with was, you know, I thought he would be difficult to talk to, you know, since he had not agreed to many interviews. I was afraid that he would be hard to talk to, and that he wouldn't open up, that he would hold back a lot of things, and that he would be suspicious a lot of my questions. But I'll tell you, it didn't turn out to be that way at all. I mean, Neil and I developed a pretty quick and good rapport. And I think partly, you know, he grew up in northwestern Ohio. You know, that's where Wapakoneta is located. And I grew up in northeastern Indiana. I grew up probably 60 to 70 miles from where he grew up, across the state line. And so even the way we spoke, accents, his parents were, came from farming families. And my background, both of my parents grew up on farms. And I had done all this work that had related to, you know, NASA and the NACA and aeronautical R&D. You know, we just kind of hit it off. I mean, both professionally and personally, and really from the start, you know, I had no trouble talking to him at all. I mean, it takes you a little bit of time, and because, you know, when you first meet him, you know, you're a little bit awestruck. I mean, here's world famous person, and you know, you're in his home and you're shaking his hand, and you know, it takes a while to get over it. And then, of course, a lot of people could never get over it because they never had enough time with him to get over it. But yeah. I pretty quickly did. I mean, the very first meeting with him before he decided to give me the green light, you know, I spent about 4 hours with him in his living room talking with him and his wife. And I got comfortable pretty quickly because, you know, I could tell he was growing in his confidence. You know, if you're an interviewer, a historian, you know, if you're not asking good questions, if you're not asking informed questions, the person that you're talking to is going to shut down pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're going to know you don't know what in the heck you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think because of my background and that I'd worked for 20 years, I taught these courses and I knew a lot of people that Neil knew, I mean, or that Neil knew about.
Oh, I see.
In fact, I can tell you when I was talking to him that very first day, and when I'd been at NASA Langley, you know, for the first years of my career, I mentioned to him the chief test pilot at Langley, a man by the name of Jack Reeder. And Jack, you know, that's not a name, you probably don't recognize it. And I don't think most, not even, you know, a lot of the experts in American aeronautical history would recognize it. But Jack was a really outstanding NASA test pilot, flew just everything from World War II right up to his retirement in the 70s. And when I mentioned the name Jack Reeder to Neil that first meeting, and I remember Carol, his wife, was in the room with us, I mentioned Jack Reeder, and Neil immediately turned. I could tell he knew him. He kind of, his face lit up, and he turned to Carol, and he said, Carol, Jack Reeder, it was the best test pilot I ever knew.
Is that right?
And then he turned to me and he said, and Chuck Yeager was the worst. And
fantastic.
I think I had him right there. I mean, I think the fact that I knew Jack Reeder and that I appreciated Jack Reeder for being a great test pilot, you know, I think that kind of clinched it for me right there. Because Neil had the same kind of appreciation for Jack that I did. And he knew that if I understood why Jack was a great test pilot and why Chuck Yeager wasn't, then I was okay. You know, I'd passed that test.
Fantastic. So what was Neil's sort of home daily life like? I mean, the impression that a lot of people had of him was that he was a recluse. He couldn't go out the front door. You know, what was he like? I mean, could he go to the hardware store and get a packet of screws?
Well, he could. I mean, there were some tough moments for sure. I mean, people in the neighborhood. He lived in a suburb of Cincinnati, and of course, you know, people around him knew it and were somewhat protective of him. The local fire department, you know, I forget, there was some sort of a security alarm or something went off once, and the fire trucks arrived at the Armstrong home, and the firemen came in, and I mean, they knew that they were entering Neil Armstrong's house, you know.
Right.
So that sort of thing happened. But he lived more normally than you would imagine. I mean, he lived in a comfortable ranch style home. You know, nothing luxurious about it. Just a very comfortable kind of ranch house in a suburb. He read a lot, and so you know, he had a very nice library in his home. He loved to play golf. Mm-hmm. He was just a few minutes from the local golf club, and he would play when, of course, Cincinnati, the weather there is, you know, it has a winter, so there's several months of the year you're not playing golf, but Neil liked to play a lot of golf, and he and Carol traveled a lot. I mean, they were not leading anything close to a reclusive life. I mean, as I said, and as you know, I mean, a couple of trips to Australia, you know, in the years right before his death, you know, they were going to, you know, all around the world, really. And normally it was an event that Neil was asked to do, and he turned down a lot of events because he was asked to do so many, but he accepted a lot of them, as well. And so they traveled, and every summer he would take one or the other of his sons to Ireland or Scotland on a golf trip.
Whole family
played golf. In fact, his one boy, Mark, played at Stanford University, which is where Tiger Woods played. So he was quite a good golfer. Mm. But you know, back to, you know, there were some things they had to watch out for. I mean, there were some kooks. There was this guy named Bart Sibrel who made a bunch of videos that argued that the Boon landings were a big hoax.
Oh, yeah. When the Fox Network,
He would bring he'd bring his Bible along and accost, you know, Apollo astronauts in airports or wherever. He did it to Neil a couple of times. In fact, he tried to rent driveway space near Neil's house, you know, so he could get video footage of Neil. And he parked out in front of Neil's house. And there was one, you know, Neil and Carol told me about one kind of, they got in their car one day not knowing that he was nearby. And then he started to follow them and they knew it. And there was kind of like a high speed chase.
Oh, my goodness.
This village of you know, in suburban Cincinnati. So there were, and then he told me a story about a guy that was following them from airport to airport, you know, that they were making a trip and it was required a couple of different stops. And this guy was, you know, was there every time they, you know, got to a new airport, and they had to call the security in for that.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, he had to be kind of on the lookout. On the other hand, you know, since he had been out of the public eye so much, over the years, you know, not doing that many public events, he could go out, you know, and people wouldn't even know. I mean, they didn't know what Neil Armstrong looked like.
Sure, sure.
I remember going with him one night after a day's interview. We went to a local ice cream shop, and we were in a fairly long line for an ice cream cone. There must have been 25 people waiting for an ice cream cone. And, you know, I got a kick out of it because, you know, nobody in the ice cream shop knew that Neil Armstrong was in there. You know, there'd been, you know, just a mass raid on him if they had found out. There we were standing, just waiting. And he ordered his ice cream and, you know, no one thought twice about it. So he could do that. He could do that as well. He kind of had both extremes going on.
Sure. That's fascinating. Okay, we're going to run out of time. We're going to pick this up in a second session, Jim, if you don't mind. Thank you for speaking to The Space Show, and we'll come back and maybe pick up a little bit more about some of your other work and what's coming up, and maybe a little bit more about Neil.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
Speak soon.
Here on The Space Show, Peter Owad was in conversation with James Hansen, the writer of the book First Man. James is a professor of history at Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama. Coming up on the Southern FM here at 8 o'clock is going to be Purple Haze, and a wonderful program that running through until it's 10 o'clock tonight. That's Purple Haze here on Southern FM. Well, we'll just bow out here now with a song by The Byrds from 1969, and it's called Armstrong, Aldrin and Collins. It does start with some sound effects first, but let's go with to the tune of Amazing Grace.
Minus 20 and counting, 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. We have ignition. 3, 2, 1. We have liftoff. Control at Houston.
ago, they had God's helping hand.
That was the Byrds, Armstrong, Aldrin and Collins, from 1969. And we're going to have more of that conversation with between Peter and James Hansen on next week's The Space Show. But right now, it's time to hand over to the good folks at Purple Haze.